May it please the court, Zach Westerfield, attorney registration number 38690, on behalf of Ms. Nicole Beatty, the plaintiff appellant in this particular matter, formerly known as Nicole Crawford, also formerly known as Nicole Turner. Your Honors, the fundamental issue before this court is a legal question. And that legal question is whether or not equitable estoppel applies in the fact situation that we have before the court. As the court has already noted, the court is well aware of the facts of this particular case. The issue is ultimately, was there, number one, two oral modifications to an existing child support order that were never approved by a court, never documented with any paperwork, and subsequently, if there was reliance on that particular issue, does the principle of equitable estoppel prevent Ms. Beatty from collecting on the actual arrearage amount that's owed in this particular case? Now, the issues before the court to begin with, as it relates to the issue of equitable estoppel, is that Mr. Turner would have to show that he reasonably relied on his to his detriment upon the acts and representations of another person, and that he had no knowledge or convenient means of knowing of the facts. And in this particular case, there was never any demonstration by Mr. Turner that he did not understand that there was a valid court order entered in 2000 directing him to pay Ms. Beatty $1,155 per month in child support. As such, I have full faith that equitable estoppel does not apply to this particular situation because the actual standard for proving equitable estoppel simply does not apply.
Mr. Westerfield, let me ask you this. In the magistrate's order, after having an evidentiary hearing, the magistrate said and made the finding that Mr. Turner relied upon Ms. Beatty's tacit longstanding agreement with the modified amount of support. So she found reliance and went on to say, and had no way of knowing that in the future, upon learning that the existing order could be enforced, she would elect to do so. Are you saying that there is no evidence in the record to support that finding by the magistrate?
I don't believe that that's what the standard would apply to in terms of what would be required for Mr. Turner to have convenient means of knowing the facts. In addition, if that is the case, I think that there's a couple of arguments that the court should be aware of. The first argument is that this issue of whether or not there was a oral agreement between the parties to modify child support on two different occasions was hotly contested at this evidentiary hearing. That's also noted in the magistrate's findings. The second issue is that the magistrate notes in her findings that specifically there was discussions between the parties about what was going on with the payment of child support, and Ms. Beatty's particular quote that the magistrate cites is that Mr. Turner would catch up on the arrears. So that's number one factually disputed, I think, and that's borne out in the record.
Well, if there's any support in the record for that finding by the magistrate, aren't we bound by that as a reviewing court?
Yes, I would say that that's correct. And obviously, there's no transcript, which is an issue in this particular case. But I think that the briefs fully vet out the issue with the rules of magistrates. A transcript is not necessarily required. Obviously, if the ruling is clearly erroneous, which is a very high standard, there might be an issue with regards to that. And those some of those allegations have been made in the briefs that have been supplied to this court. The second thing is that even if there was theoretically an issue of potential equitable estoppel, should equitable estoppel be applied in this particular case? The existing case law that applies equitable estoppel to the collection of arrearage on child support is very, very narrowly defined and very narrowly limited. the case law on this particular subject, kind of the seminal case that's been cited by Mr. Turner, is the In Re Marriage of Denning case. And that case is a situation in which there was a failed adoption proceeding, and the father had no knowledge that the adoption proceeding was failed, and there was a partial issue of some arrears could be collected, but not all of the arrears. It was an issue of when he became aware that the adoption proceeding had failed, that the court kind of turned on when the arrears would start to accrue and when they would not start to accrue. So I think the fundamental issue before this court is that even if equitable estoppel, even if there is the two elements needed for equitable estoppel, should equitable estoppel even apply to this particular situation? And it appears that the case law is very well settled, that child support is for the benefit of the child, that the child cannot waive his or her right to child support, and that the parties themselves cannot contractually agree to waive or reduce child support. And if that does particularly happen, then the court would have to go back and make specific findings of fact under Colorado Revised Statute. I believe it's 1410.115. And again, I would argue that if we did go down that path, that those specific findings were not made. In the briefs, there's not really any argument made by Mr. Turner that A, the child support that was agreed upon can be contractually waived, that it can be contractually agreed upon, and that ultimately this entire situation was to the benefit of the minor child in this particular circumstance. In the court's order, she kind of talks about, in paragraph 3 of the order dated August 16th, 2010, that the central question in respondent's objection to the writ of withholding is whether the parties informally agreed to reduce the child support obligation in 2003 and 2006. The court notes that if the answer is in the negative, then respondent's arrears approximate $30,000. Otherwise, they are but a fraction of this particular amount. And I think that that is a gross misstatement of the law, that that's not necessarily the only or central question that was before the magistrate. That is, seems to be question number one, what I would call maybe the gatekeeping question. But question number two is, if there was this oral modification of child support and equitable estoppel potentially applied, was that decision in the best interest of the child pursuant to 1410.115? And in such a case, the case law indicates that specific findings of fact would have to be made regarding the court retroactively approving that decision. At least that seems to be what the case law suggests to myself.
Does the case law talk about the overlay of the best interests of the child standard on top of equitable estoppel? My recollection of the cases is that equitable estoppel doesn't discuss at all the best interests of the child.
Equitable estoppel functions, Your Honor, from my understanding of the case law, as a way to say if there is an arrearage amount that is not documented by a court, that there's an equitable reason why that arrearage amount should not have to be paid by the obligor to the obligee. I think that in this particular situation, though, I would note that there's no on-point case that has the facts of this particular case. There is no on-point case that says when two parties have agreed two different times to reduce child support based upon alleged change in circumstance, obviously, again, this issue was hotly disputed by Ms. Beatty, that equitable estoppel would apply. My understanding of the case law says that the courts that have looked at that particular issue have not addressed the issue of equitable estoppel. What the courts who have looked at that issue have focused on is, can the parties contractually agree to reduce child support? And what those courts have held is that the answer to that is generally no, because under 1410.122, the statutory exception to retroactively modifying child support is only a change in the shared physical custody of the minor child. And here we have no change in the shared physical custody of the child. The child always resided with the mother. So the cases that have looked at that particular situation have said that, number one, the parties can't do this. The parties cannot contract away a child's right to child support. It's for the benefit of the child. If mom cannot contract away a child's right, then how can equity step in and then say, well, because of an equitable situation, we're basically going to have a situation where we have an implied waiver, I guess is the best way I would describe it, of child support.
See, though, that it's different from if the court says
And the cases, there are some cases, as you point out, that say you can't contractually waive the right to child support. But we don't have a full waiver here, if anything. We have just a reduction. And we don't have any indication, correct me if I'm wrong, in this record indicating that the child was not being adequately cared for as a result of the reduced payments.
There is no record of that. And part of that is because we don't have a transcript. Part of that is some of the supplementary secondary arguments that were raised in the brief that Ms. Beatty was not properly prepared for the hearing in Boulder because she was living in Alaska. She was not properly served. She hired counsel the day before. The sworn financial statement supplied by Mr. Turner was supplied literally the day of the hearing. The preparation for the hearing and some of those facts are undisputed, and that's fully explained in the briefs, but you're right, that the record before the court right now doesn't show that there was any harm. But the question then would become, is it Ms. Beatty's job to show that there was no harm, or to show, I guess, does she have a positive obligation to show harm to the minor child in order to collect on the arrearage? I think that what the case law suggests is that the court has to go through an analysis of 1410.115 to say that, retroactively speaking, those oral modifications were in the best interest of the child. And the court, in its order dated August 16, 2010, never once cited to 1410.115. The court never once says that these agreements were in the best interest of the child. The court almost gets there by saying there was no evidence that the child was harmed or that the child couldn't participate in activities, but the court doesn't say that according to the statute and these nine provisions under that particular part of the statute, that these reductions were in fact in the best interest of the kids, of the single minor child. And as such, the requirements under 1410.115, best interest of the child, have been met. And my understanding of the case law is that those findings have to be specific. And those findings are not specific. And as I'll again note, the court never cites that statute in her ruling. If I can I save the rest of my time for rebuttal? Thank you. May I please the court?
May I please this court? My name is Lee Warkentin. My registration number is 6018. I believe it's helpful if the court will have a brief summary of the factual situation that results in this case being here. Mr. Turner filed in 2009 a motion to modify child support and at the same time filed an objection to a writ of withholding that he had been served with from the state of Texas. The reason he filed his motions at that time because he was shocked and surprised to find that the petitioner in this case was suddenly asserting that he owed a greater amount of child support than what he had been paying based upon the agreements of the parties from the time period of 2003 to the present. The evidence that was presented at the hearing, and the court has to assume that the court at that hearing made the findings necessary to support its decision because we do not have a transcript here to review. But the court at that time held a hearing in April 14 of 2010. It issued a written order 2 days later as it related to the issue of child support. The court at that time instructed counsel to submit briefs on the issue of arrears, which also was heard at the same time as the motion to modify. Mr. Turner had attempted to set these on separate dates, but the court, in the interest of judicial economy, determined that it should be all heard at one time. We then had a hearing. Ms. Turner appeared. She has raised in her appeal that there was an insufficiency of process. I would submit to this court that that issue has been waived because the petitioner in this case, one, did not file any responsive filings or pleadings alleging that service was improper. She appeared at the hearing. She presented evidence at that hearing. At no time did she raise the sufficiency of process in any formal method at which is required by Rule 12.8. Not having raised it in a formal filing, she has waived it. So clearly the court had jurisdiction to hear this case. In regards to the motion to modify child support, the court held a hearing. The court heard the evidence that it considered necessary in order to make its decision. The court considered the exhibits And I think it's very important to note, in the court's ruling, the court found that the respondent, Mr. Turner, was more credible, but that she had considered very heavily the evidence that was presented by Ms. Turner concerning the payments that had been made by Ms. Turner during this period of time. The court found specifically that the parties entered into two separate agreements, one in 2003 because there was no longer child care. Well, I think it's fairly obvious that children, as they grow older, certainly don't have child care. As the court pointed out, that is a very significant variable in a determination of child support. So it's certainly be reasonable to expect parties to reconsider their support obligation when child care is no longer necessary. The court found that the parties entered into an agreement at that time to reduce their support from the $1,155 to $900. This is in 203. The court found once again in 206, based upon circumstances, that the parties exchanged financial information verbally, court makes that finding, and that the respondent in this case referred to the child support guidelines, the statutory determination of what support should be online, and made a determination of what the support should be under those circumstances. The court then found that those agreements were relied upon by Mr. Turner, and that there was no way that he would ever be able to know that she was later going to come back and say, wait a minute, you now owe me $1,155. In fact, when she did that, immediately he filed this objection to the writ of withholding, saying, wait a minute, that's not the amount that should be, I should be required to pay. Excuse me. So we have all the necessary elements of estoppel. We have an act, we have reliance upon that act, and we have no ability by Mr. Turner to be able to determine that she was not going to enforce the agreement that the parties had reached. I think it's even stronger case than the Denon case, which is the adoption case, which the court I'm sure is familiar with. In that case, the party's husband relinquishes his parental rights. He's going to. Mother doesn't go through with the adoption, the step-parent adoption, and later comes back and says, hey, I want child support. Well, in that case, the father very easily could have determined by checking the court's record whether or not the adoption took place. There was nowhere for Mr. Turner to turn to except to Mrs. Turner. And when he did, when he turned to Ms. Crawford, she said, yeah. In fact, let's modify it again. So it's a stronger case for the application of equitable adoption or equitable estoppel than if it only happened once or even in the adoption setting. And the court made that specific finding here. Made the finding.
Mr. Workington, sure. But here it seems it is different because your client was a party to a proceeding in which an order had been entered requiring him to pay a certain level, a certain amount of child support.
Right.
In Denon, the father was not the party to the adoption proceeding. There was no order relating to him that he had been a party to. And so he was really in the dark. Here your client is not in the dark. He knows he has a legal obligation to pay a certain amount. Doesn't that distinguish it from the Denon case?
I would say, in terms of did he know about the order, sure he did. Did the father in Denham know that mother wanted to adopt? Sure. Did father know that she hadn't? He could have found out very easily.
But he didn't know. I mean, here, he didn't know a crucial fact, but in this case, husband knew the fact of what he'd been ordered to pay.
I guess it's what you consider the crucial fact.
Yeah.
I would submit the crucial fact is, did he know that Ms. Turner, 7 years later, would she come out and ask for the full amount of support when she never wants evidence clear during this entire time. He paid regularly. Child did not do without. She accepted the payments. She did nothing ever in that process to say, wait a minute, you owe me $1,155. You don't owe me $900. You don't owe me $750. You owe me a greater amount.
But if the law is that the parties cannot, by contract, escape their responsibilities to provide adequate child support, as the Combs case says, mm-hmm. How can they do that by some tacit agreement?
Well, I think there's other law that applies as well that would override whether or not by contract. I think even though parties cannot by contract modify, the court can determine that it would be unfair to enforce the order as originally entered under the circumstances of these, of this case and of the facts of various cases.
But what if the unfairness is, as you allege, an agreement? I mean, because, well, but why is that? If the parties can't contract to modify child support, mm-hmm. they have to go to court, and the court has to make findings under 1410.115. If the parties can't contract, if it's not enforceable, how is it enforceable if they don't enter a written contract, but they just act as if there's a contract? I guess I'm not getting the distinction.
That's where equitable estoppel comes in. That's what it's about.
But why do we elevate equity to that level when wouldn't the equities exist in a contract case? After all, my ex-wife has agreed in a written contract to reduce child support. Right. How am I to know that she's going to come back later and claim that I owe more than what I've now contracted to pay? Why aren't the equities just the same?
Well, there is no, I'm not sure what you're referring to. You're referring to the Denham case, there was no contract.
No, no, I'm referring to the Combs case. That you can't, the parties can't enter into a contract to modify the child support that's enforceable. And in that case, though, if that were to happen, wouldn't the parties have the same argument? Hey, we had a contract. I had no reason to know she was going to go back on her contract.
They would. They could have that same argument. Absolutely, they could. But where it happens more than once, I think the argument becomes less effective, because here not only did he do it, they agree one time, they did it the second time, they exchanged financial information by phone, by finding, they looked at the guidelines, they went through the necessary step to determine their support obligation. The only thing they didn't do is say, judge, put your stamp of approval on it.
Well,
now, we have it on both sides,
but isn't the reason that we have this rule that you can't contract to modify child support because of the child, not what the parents want, but because we're trying to protect the child? That seems to me to be the premise of that. How is allowing enforcement, essentially, of a tacit agreement under equitable estoppel necessarily or in any way in the interests of the child? I mean, it may be, but it seems to me you've got to go back and look at what's in the child's best interests.
I would agree that the child's concerns or best interests are certainly paramount in any of these. But one of the critical factors is when a parent continues to receive support in excess of the amount that the state of Colorado has said is an appropriate amount to pay under these circumstances, it would be unfair to penalize the father. It would be unfair to take money away from the child if those were not the facts. But the facts in this case and the findings of this court said this is a perfect example of why equitable estoppel should apply. I would submit that if you didn't use equitable estoppel, you should use plain equity. It would be unfair under these circumstances, such as the finding in the Rivera case, 91 P 3rd 464. Again, it was a case without a transcript for the Court of Appeals to consider. But in that case, this court specifically stated, however, courts have equitable authority to set aside or reduce a support judgment. Okay? Support judgment is an obligation exists, it wasn't paid. Becomes a judgment. That's law. In circumstances that would render its enforcement fundamentally unfair or unjust.
Here the court didn't do it. The parties did. I mean, just as in Combs, you have a contract in Combs. I'm just trying to see what's more unfair about your client's situation versus in Combs. In Combs, if you think about it, it's unfair. The parties had a contract to reduce child support. That would seem to be unfair to whoever is being forced to pay more to disregard that contract. I mean, why is it any more unfair to refuse to enforce some tacit agreement by conduct?
I think in that case, the issue was whether or not the amount was adequate. And the court in that case said you can't escape paying an adequate amount. In this case, the court made specific findings that the amount was adequate. The child did not do without. And in fact, it was based upon the support guidelines in effect, the amount of support that they agreed to. It was simply a mechanical act of getting the court's approval. In the Combs case, I believe that, and I may be wrong, but I believe that in the Combs case, the court made a specific finding in that case that the support was not even close to being the amount that should have been being paid during this period of time. In this case, the court found not only was it being paid, it was being paid on a regular basis without objection and based upon the parties' specific discussion with each other about their respective financial circumstances, the circumstances of the child. In fact, the court, although denying this, heard evidence as to various expenses incurred by my client in order to exercise parenting time. And the court said, no, I'm not going to consider that. I'm not going to adjust his support in the amount that ultimately the court determined he should owe based upon the arrears. Any other questions about that? Thank you. Your Honor, I would also submit that due to the fact there is no transcript in this case, this court and the brief is replete with assertions about the evidence that was presented that is not before this court, and we've asked that the court not consider those assertions in our responsive brief. Clearly, the court must assume that the findings that were made by the magistrate and by the district court in review of the magistrate's decisions are supported by the record and are supported by the facts that were presented at hearing. The court and the magistrate went through a very, very specific, detailed review of what was required in order to find that this case fit into this very narrow, as she refers to it, envelope, or very narrow case fact setting that would justify the application of equitable estoppel. Your Honor, we're asking that the decision of the magistrate and the district court affirming the decision of the magistrate be upheld. Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court. Mr. Workentine has made some arguments that there's a number of assertions that are made in the briefs in this particular case that are unsupported because there's no transcript. And while I can see that there is not a transcript, that doesn't mean that there's not a record. And the record is 146 pages long, and the court can consider that record. And if the record shows that the magistrate's decision was clearly erroneous, then the findings of fact that are made by the magistrate can be overturned. And there's a number of things in the record that are very concerning. The magistrate and Mr. Workentine talk about how child support was consistently paid. It was on time. It was 100% the way it was supposed to be. That's not true. If you read Mr. Workentine's brief on behalf of Mr. Turner that was filed with the court in May of 2010 at the behest of the court, he indicates that he was $8,180 in arrears. So not only is Mr. Turner saying that there was this contract to reduce child support, but he's saying, even though there was this contract to reduce child support to this amount, I wasn't living up to that agreement because I was $8,180 in arrears. If you look at the affidavits supplied by Mr. Turner that are attached to the original motions filed in June of 2009, those affidavits indicate that there was only one circumstance in which the parties changed the child support agreement, and that was to $812.50. The magistrate also made a number of other glaring mistakes when reviewing the record in this particular matter. She said that the parties agreed to reduce child support initially to $900 and then subsequently to $750. The admissions made by Mr. Turner in his affidavit supporting the initial motion as well as in the briefs filed in May of 2010 indicate that that's not true. That his testimony at trial and the argument made by counsel was that those agreements were for $975, not $900, and were for $812.50, not $750. The fact of the matter is that the magistrate looked at this case, was disgusted that it had been on her docket for 10 months. She wanted the case to go to a hearing, and ultimately we had a trial by ambush. And I found that it's interesting that Mr. Turner argues equity in a situation in which Ms. Turner was never served, did not properly prepare for the hearing, did not have adequate time to retain counsel, and it's undisputed if you read the arguments and the briefs submitted to the district court at the petition for review that a continuance was asked for. There doesn't need to be a transcript because Mr. Workentine concedes that he argued service of process was insufficient, Ms. Turner is not prepared, Ms. Bailey is not prepared for the hearing, we need to have a continuance. that argument doesn't need to be transcribed because we agree that that argument was made. And then to come in and say that equity demands that Mr. Turner not have to pay his court-ordered child support obligation is absolutely ludicrous to me, considering the facts and the circumstance in which Ms. Turner was dragged into court and wholly unprepared. And again, the finding of the court never says that 14-10-115 was met and the best interests of the child were met. That burden is not on Ms. Turner. That burden is on Mr. Workington. Thank you.
Both for the arguments today. We will consider the case submitted. We will get you a written opinion in due course.